This is Gene with the BBC World News for April 9, 2026. Has U.S. achieved its war objectives in Iran? In the weeks since the U.S. and Israel launched strikes on Iran, the battle for the narrative over the war's progress has been taking place at the heart of American military power. From week one, I've been inside the Pentagon press briefings given by the U.S. Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, the former Army National Guard major, and Fox News pundit. From the first update to reporters, when he set out America's war aims, until the latest, which followed the announcement of a two-week truce, the man running the world's most powerful military has brought his TV-style on-screen monologue to the Pentagon podium. The briefings have been chest-thumping affairs, reveling in portrayals of American military supremacy. Hegseth said on Wednesday the U.S. had scored a capital V military victory. At another briefing, he said the U.S. had dealt death and destruction from the sky all day long. Getting to the truth of the war's progress and its toll on the U.S., however, has taken deeper interrogation. So, with a tenuous ceasefire in place that is already being tested, what can we say the U.S. has achieved, and at what cost has it come? President Trump's core war goal was to deny Iran the ability to develop a nuclear weapon, something Iran has said it never planned to do. This, however, has also been a years-long objective of U.S.-led diplomacy. Ultimately, Trump believed the 2015 Obama-backed global nuclear deal with Iran, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, was too weak. In his first term, Trump violated it, effectively pulling the U.S. out by reapplying sanctions on Iran, which had been in compliance with the deal. This was ultimately a choice of force over diplomacy. He later killed the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps officer, General Qasem Soleimani, setting a pattern with Tehran in which he has zigzagged between diplomatic outreach and military action. It is that pattern that culminated in the current war. But as the tenuous ceasefire remains in place, there is little evidence of any significant result for Trump on the nuclear issue. He said last June that Iran's nuclear capabilities were already obliterated by his bombing raids on nuclear sites at Isfahan, Fordow, and Natanz. After a further 5 weeks of war, today Iran maintains its stockpile of near-weapons-grade enriched uranium, which is thought to be contained in gas cylinders under rubble. In the third week of the war, Rafael Grossi, the head of the global nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, told me there could ultimately be no military solution to Iran's nuclear ambitions. Trump has said the U.S. will now work with Iran to dig up and remove all the deeply buried nuclear dust. But Tehran remains defiant on this issue, and it will be decisive once in the incoming negotiations between the U.S. and Iran in Islamabad. Arguably, Tehran could now, with an even more suspicious leadership in place, become more, not less, determined to seek a nuclear capability to deter another U.S. attack. When Trump announced the war in social media video from his Mar-a-Lago estate, his stated objectives included regime change, calling on Iranians to take over their government when the U.S.-Israeli bombing stopped. Within days, he demanded the regime's unconditional surrender, something that hasn't happened. Although Israel has killed senior figures, including the supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, his son Mojtaba was named his successor. Trump has said the new leadership is less, quote, radicalized and far more intelligent, end quote, than its predecessors. He hoped to repeat the result of his attack on Venezuela, where his forces snatched President Nicolas Maduro and put him in a New York jail cell, leaving the remaining leadership in Caracas pliant to Washington's will. But there is so far no evidence of this happening in Tehran. On Iran's arsenal, Trump's top officials say the U.S. has destroyed its conventional capabilities, obliterating its missiles, launchers, drones, armed factory, and navy. In the case of missile and drone stocks, this claim has been disputed via leaked intelligence assessments, suggesting Iran, in fact, maintains about half of its pre-war arsenal. The BBC has not been able to verify either claim. Either way, the Trump administration's stated aims have shifted. The Trump administration's stated aims, that is, have shifted since the outset of this war, with the U.S.-Israeli objective of regime change failing to materialize. 13 U.S. service members have been killed, and hundreds more wounded. Munition supplies are said to have been expended at a rapid rate, including large numbers of Tomahawk missiles and an estimated price tag to the war of more than $1 billion a day. U.S. officials, meanwhile, say unmatched military skill and technological prowess has completed an aerial campaign ahead of schedule that has forced a capitulation by Iran. At home, meanwhile, there has been a political cost for Trump. Polling has consistently suggested a minority of Americans approve of the war. Trump's standing in Congress has largely been split along partisan lines, with Republicans backing him. By early this week, however, some were openly opposing his social media threat to destroy a whole civilization. Throughout the war, influential figures in his MAGA movement, like the podcast host and journalist Tucker Carlson, sharply split with him. On Sunday, as Trump escalated his threats to destroy Iranian infrastructure, Marjorie Taylor Greene, once one of his biggest cheerleaders, who has since broken with him, said, "This is not making America great again. This is evil." These fractures show few signs of healing within Trump's movement. Democrats, meanwhile, were equally outraged at Trump's increasingly wild threats, as well as his insults to America's allies. They urged the administration to answer questions about whether a U.S. missile was behind the strike on a school in the town of Minab on day one of the war, killing at least 168 people, including 110 children. If confirmed, this would be one of the worst cases of civilian casualties from a U.S. strike in the Middle East in a generation. I pressed both Hegseth and Secretary of State Marco Rubio about it. The Pentagon has said it is investigating, but nearly 6 weeks later has released no findings. This week, several lawmakers called for his cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to seize power from a sitting president. The administration argues Trump's threats forced Iran to back down, and his press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, said, "Never underestimate President Trump's ability to successfully advance America's interest and broker peace." A clearer verdict on that may come from Americans in November. The global economic fallout of the Strait of Hormuz closure has already sparked higher petrol and diesel prices for Americans. This is set to feed through to sticker shock at the grocery store, with anger at increasing costs already predicted to make this year's midterm elections uncomfortable for Trump's party. This could become even worse due to the war, potentially costing the Republicans control of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate. For the Republican Party, that would be a steep price to pay. Trump had to respond to the looming economic crisis as Iran used the tactics of insurgency to respond to a conventional aerial war. His war aim became the need to reopen a strait that was open when he started the war. As Iran took control of the Strait of Hormuz, Trump flip-flopped repeatedly on how to respond. He went from demanding allies help reopeners open the strait to saying the U.S. did not need their help, to calling for them to help, to calling long-standing allies toward cowards for not doing so. NATO's already fraying cohesion, deepened by Trump's designs on Greenland, has been supercharged by the Iran war. Trump has renewed his attacks on the alliance, which avoided formal involvement. After talks at the White House, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said the conversation was, quote, very frank. The president may believe that overwhelming American military superiority will safeguard America's role as a superpower in the long term, but European nations are already looking at ways to de-risk away from what they see as a now unpredictable, unreliable protector. This is a potential economic and strategic gain for China, and one that has caused dismay among Trump's critics in Washington. The true costs of this war are yet to be counted, and if this ceasefire or delicate negotiations fail, they could become far steeper. Lebanon thought there was a ceasefire, then Israel unleashed deadly blitz. The guns were supposed to have fallen silent. It was, after all, just hours after U.S. President Donald Trump had announced that a 2-week ceasefire had been agreed to halt the war in the Middle East. But just as the region was breathing a sigh of relief, Israeli jets conducted a 10-minute blitz across Lebanon, a massive aerial attack that killed at least 203 people and wounded more than 1,000 others, according to Lebanon's health ministry. Local and Western condemnation was swift and widespread, but no criticism came from the U.S. against its ally in this war. Iran said this was a grave violation of the ceasefire deal and has asked the U.S. to halt the Israeli aggression. Lebanese officials say more than 1,700 people have been killed since Israel launched its latest campaign in Lebanon last month. Israel has said its operations are aimed at weakening Hezbollah and achieving what it calls remaining military objectives. The war began with U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran on February 28, prompting retaliation from Tehran against U.S. allies in the Gulf and from Iran's proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen, against Israel. In response, Israel began striking Hezbollah and even ordered its troops to occupy large parts of Lebanon. The 2-week pause in the fighting was announced by Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, who has been serving as mediator between the warring parties. Sharif said the U.S. and its allies have agreed to an immediate ceasefire everywhere, including Lebanon and elsewhere. Pakistan is due to host the parties on Friday with a U.S. 15-point plan and an Iranian 10-point set of counterproposals seemingly on the table as starting points for the negotiations. Iran's plan insists on a cessation of hostilities on all fronts, including against the resistance of Lebanon, a reference to its Shia ally in Lebanon. But the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the ceasefire did not include Lebanon. Donald Trump also said Lebanon was not part of the deal because of Hezbollah. According to him, the war in Lebanon is a separate skirmish. It was around 11 GMT when the skies over Lebanon darkened. The Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, said that with 10 minutes, it had completed the largest coordinated strike across Lebanon since the start of Operation Roaring Lion, the code name for the Israeli operation against Iran. It said it had targeted over 100 Hezbollah headquarters, military arrays, and command and control centers in Beirut, Bekaa, and southern Lebanon. Densely populated parts of central Beirut were hit in strikes described by officials as among the heaviest since Hezbollah joined the conflict in early March. And it was not just the traditional Hezbollah stronghold of Dahiya that was hit in the Lebanese capital. The city center was also hit. Casualties were reported in the Bekaa Valley in the east and in the southern Nabatea, Sidon, and Tyre regions. Hezbollah may have been taken by surprise. Their only response appeared to have been with rockets fired toward Israel hours later. On Thursday, Israel continued its attacks, saying it had killed over 70 terrorists. The IDF also said it had eliminated Ali Yusuf Harshi, the personal secretary to Hezbollah Secretary General Naim Qassem in Beirut. There has been no confirmation. The BBC is unable to verify the claims. On a crisp and sunny morning, there is a heaviness in the air in Beirut. Usually the streets are buzzing with traffic, but the country is observing a day of national mourning. Prime Minister Nawaz Salam said civilians were targeted. The casualties were martyrs and wounded. President Joseph Aoun described it as a massacre. At some locations, search and recovery operations are still underway. There is nothing left of the 10-story residential building that was attacked in Talat el-Kayat, a well-to-do neighborhood of western Beirut, one of the many locations hit. The airstrike happened without warning and would have caught everyone by surprise, as this is not an area that has been targeted. Civil defense teams are now combing through buildings here and across the country, but there is little hope for people who still have loved ones missing. Zayed Samit Itani, who was leading the civil defense team, said this was new to Beirut. Teams were exhausted after more than 6 weeks of constant attacks by Israel. I have 22 years' experience. For us, this is something like normal. But for other people, it's not normal, Itani said, adding, I'm sad, like everybody. Even though Israel says it targeted Hezbollah, it knew that this would inevitably lead to a high number of casualties. It is difficult to see what the long-term Israeli strategy is. Even Israeli military officials acknowledge what has been known in Lebanon for a long time, that Hezbollah will not be disarmed by force. The attacks may give Israel some military gain, but this is likely to be limited. In Lebanon, opponents and supporters of Hezbollah are coming together in anger, united in the view that what happens here was unacceptable and unjustifiable. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Saeed Khatibzadeh told the BBC's Today program the U.S. had to choose whether it wanted war or peace. The minister said Iran would provide security for safe passage through the Strait of Hormuz, the strategic waterway whose blockage has sent oil and gas prices spiraling, but reopening will only happen after the United States actually withdraw this aggression, an apparent reference to Israel's attacks on Lebanon. Argentina passes bill loosening protection of its glaciers. Argentina's Congress has passed a controversial amendment making it easier to mine its glacier regions, a move environmentalists say weakens protections for crucial water sources. The pioneering glacier law, approved in 2010, prohibited all mining and exploration activities in glacier regions by protecting them as water reserves. The reform shifts the responsibility of defining protected glacier areas from the Argentine Institute for Snow, Ice, and Environmental Sciences to the provincial governments. President Javier Milei, who backed the reform, said the change empowers the provinces to utilize their resources and allows mining activities where there was nothing to protect. Argentina's Senate had already approved the bill in February 2026, so approval by the lower house was the last major hurdle left. Opponents of the reform argued that it would put a fundamental resource, water, at risk. Without water, we can't even think about a growth and development project, Congresswoman Natalia de la Sota said. But a backer of the bill, Congresswoman Nancy Picon Martinez, said that the mining industry was being portrayed as if it were a monster. This law protects glaciers, no matter how much some people want us to believe otherwise, she said. Following the reform, glaciers and periglacial environments, which may not be covered by ice, but are frozen at least part of the year, will be protected by the National Inanguilla Inventory until provincial leaders prove they do not serve as strategic water reserves. There are 16,968 glaciers in Argentina, providing water to 36 river basins across 12 provinces, home to 7 million people. Water from melted glaciers helps to reduce the impact of droughts, especially in semi-arid provinces like Mendoza, which are becoming more common due to climate change. Governors from the mineral-rich provinces of Catamarca, Jujuy, Salta, Mendoza, and San Juan had expressed their support for the bill, stating that the 2010 glacier law hindered the goal of promoting a sustainable economic development of the provinces and the nation without compromising future generations. But Greenpeace has criticized the bill for arguing that not all glaciers and periglacial environments act as strategic water reserves. The primary function of all glaciers and the entire periglacial environment is to act as a freshwater reservoir, Agustina Rossi Serra, a biologist working with Greenpeace, said. The periglacial environment, apart from being water reserves, because they consist of water inside, undergoes a gradual thaw that feeds the rivers and streams of our country, she explains. And a large part of our country, especially the regions that were keen to see this law amended, are arid and semi-arid areas where water is a scarce resource, Rossi Serra added. Defense Secretary reveals month-long Russian submarine operation over cables and pipelines north of the UK. A Russian submarine operation was detected in and around British waters by the UK and its allies during a month-long operation, UK Defense Secretary John Healey told a Downing Street press conference today. He said the Akula attack submarine and two Googie spy submarines have since left UK waters and headed back north after the spy vessels spent time over critical infrastructure relevant to us and our allies. Healey added there was no evidence that there has been any damage to UK cables and pipelines, but that any attempt to damage the infrastructure would not be tolerated and will have serious consequences. This appears to be a more sophisticated and clandestine Russian operation, writes the BBC's defense correspondent, while our security correspondent explains why the UK's dependence on the cables and pipelines comes with vulnerability. The defense secretary also said the UK is stepping up its defense efforts by spending an extra £100 million on submarine hunting aircraft and launching the Atlantic Bastion program to create a British-built hybrid naval force. In a message to Russian President Vladimir Putin, Healey says, "We see you." Husband arrested over disappearance of Michigan woman in Bahamas. Authorities in the Bahamas have arrested a man in relation to the disappearance of Lynette Hooker, an American woman who vanished while out on a small boat, police in the island country said on Wednesday. A 59-year-old from the U.S. was arrested in Abaco and was being questioned, the Royal Bahamas Police Force said in a statement. It did not name the man. U.S. media, including the BBC's partner, CBS News, reported that the man arrested was the woman's husband, Brian Hooker, who had been on the boat with her. In a statement, Brian Hooker's lawyer said he categorically and unequivocally denies any wrongdoing. The lawyer added that her client has been cooperating with the relevant authorities as part of an ongoing investigation and would not comment further. The Royal Bahamas Police did not immediately respond to the BBC's request for further details about the arrest. It earlier confirmed that it was investigating and that multiple agencies were searching for the woman. A U.S. Coast Guard official confirmed to the BBC on Wednesday that a criminal investigation was opened into the woman's disappearance. The Coast Guard was not able to comment on the specifics of the investigation, including potential suspects in the case. Brian Hooker earlier said his wife went missing after falling out of an 8-foot hard-bottomed dinghy on Saturday and being swept out to sea by strong currents. In a statement on Wednesday, Brian Hooker thanked authorities and volunteers for the ongoing search. "I am heartbroken over the recent boat accident in unpredictable seas and high winds that caused my beloved Lynette to fall from our small dinghy near Elbow Key in the Bahamas," he said. "Despite desperate attempts to reach her, the winds and currents drove us further apart. We continue to search for her, and that is my sole focus." Lynette Hooker's daughter, Carly Aylesworth, told CBS that her mother had been sailing for more than 10 years and was an experienced swimmer. She said she did not understand how her mother could have fallen overboard and disappeared, and asked that authorities thoroughly investigate the incident. Brian Hooker is also said to have told police that he and his wife left Hopetown for Elbow Key in the Abaco Islands on Saturday evening, and it was at that point that she fell overboard, taking the boat's keys with her. He reportedly said he then paddled the vessel to shore and made it to the Marsh Harbor boatyard at about 4 local time on Sunday. He then told a person that his wife was missing, and that person then informed the authorities. Best-selling The Housemaid author Freda McFadden reveals true identity. One of the biggest mysteries in publishing has been solved after the best-selling U.S. author known to millions of readers as Freda McFadden revealed her true identity. McFadden has been one of the world's most popular authors of recent years, thanks to thrillers like The Housemaid. The author has never made a secret of the fact Freda McFadden is a pseudonym and that she also works as a doctor, but had never revealed her true name. She has now told USA Today she is actually Sarah Cohen. "I'm at a point in my career when I'm tired of this being a secret," she explained. "I'm tired of people debating if I'm a real person or if I'm three men. I am a real person, and I have a real identity, and I don't have anything to hide." Under the name McFadden, she was the second best-selling author of 2025 in the UK, selling 2.6 million books, and sold 6 million print copies in her home country. Those sales were fueled by the success of The Housemaid, which was first published in 2022 and was turned into a film last year, starring Sydney Sweeney and Amanda Seyfried. Only the Gruffalo author Julia Donaldson sold more books overall than McFadden in the UK in 2025. She is a prolific writer, having published 29 novels so far, and has already topped the bestseller charts this year with three books, The Housemaid, Want to Know a Secret, and Dear Debbie. Cohen initially chose a pen name to hide her true identity when she self-published her first book, a fictionalized account of her life as a resident doctor titled The Devil Wears Scrubs in 2013. She chose the name Freda as a medical in-joke after a hospital training registry, the Fellowship and Residency Electronic Interactive Database. She continued writing while working as a doctor specializing in brain disorders in Boston, Massachusetts, and her publishing career took off when she began penning psychological thrillers. But she kept the two identities separate, telling the New York Times in 2024 that she worried her patients might feel weird about being treated by a best-selling thriller writer. "At work, I want to be a doctor," she said, "and a lot of my books have medical stuff in them, and I don't want people saying, 'Is this based on me?' It feels unprofessional." The same year, she told the Washington Post she didn't like to be the center of attention. "I love that people are reading my book," she said, "but the spotlight on me, specifically, is hard." "It's not just about privacy, but also about social anxiety," she told the paper, saying her success as an author had escalated her fears that she may not be that amazing person that everyone expects her to be. But that success allowed her to go part-time as a doctor in 2023, and she has now scaled back that work further, making it easier to reveal her true identity. "My whole goal was to keep it a secret until I was ready to step back from my doctor job, so it wouldn't be like everyone I work with suddenly knew, and it compromised my ability to do my job," she told USA Today. "But I have stepped away from my job. I'm only working like once or twice a month." She added, "I just realized I was completely overwhelmed from trying to do both." It had also become increasingly difficult to maintain her double identity. She told the Times this January, "One of my colleagues at the hospital recently recognized me in a Freda photo and told everyone, so the cat is out of the bag." "But they've been really respectful about not posting anything about me on social media, and I tried to repay them with a book signing at work," When doing public interviews or appearances as Frida, Cohen wears a wig, but only because I have no idea how to style my hair, she told USA Today. She said she still wants her fans, the Mech fans and the Frida Readabs, to continue to know her by her pen name. Even though I haven't told my real name until now, I feel like I have shared the real me all along, and everything I've told them has been the truth, she said. Even though the name will be a surprise, nothing else will. I've always been genuine with my readers. Artemis crew returning to Earth with all the good stuff from moon discoveries. The Artemis II crew said they have many more pictures and many more stories to share with the world as they prepare to return to Earth. The four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft have completed their mission around the moon and are expected to splash down off the coast of San Diego on around 20 Friday. Speaking to media from space on their way home, the mission's pilot, Victor Glover, said the crew was eager to share what they had seen with the world. It was the first time hearing from the team since their historic lunar flyby that saw them travel further from Earth than any other humans. When asked during Wednesday evening's conference about re-entry to Earth, Glover said, "We have to get back. There's so much data that you've already seen, but all the good stuff is coming back with us." "There's so many more pictures, so many more stories," he said. Glover added that the crew still had two more days before they could begin to process what they'd been through. "I'm going to be thinking about and talking about all these things for the rest of my life," he said. The Artemis II mission's spacecraft, Orion, broke the record for human travel at about 1356 EDT on Monday, beating a record of 248,655 miles held since 1970 by the Apollo 13 mission. The spacecraft was not planning to land on the moon, but fly around its far side, the side which is never visible from Earth. Satellites have photographed the far side before, but the astronauts were the first human eyes to see some parts of the far side's surface and its vast craters and lava plains. Straight after the flyby, President Trump spoke with the Orion team and congratulated them. "Today you've made history and you made all America really proud, incredibly proud," he said. During the most recent virtual news conference at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, the four astronauts once again beamed into a live stream as a microphone floated between them. They each took turns answering questions from reporters with considerable delays. The crew was asked by the Los Angeles Times about the 40 minutes of profound solitude when they lost contact with Earth. Commander Reid Wiseman said the crew had a lot of scientific work to do, and it was probably the most critical lunar observations for our geology team. "But the four of us took a moment. We shared maple cookies that Jeremy has brought, and we took about 3 or 4 minutes, just as a crew, to really reflect on where we were," he said. For Glover, the greatest gift of the mission was seeing the lunar eclipse from beyond the far side of the moon. For Wiseman, the pinnacle moment was when his team named a lunar crater after Wiseman's late wife, Carol, who died of cancer in 2020. "I think when Jeremy spelled Carol's name, I think for me that is when I was overwhelmed with emotion. And I looked over and Christina was crying," Reid said. "Just for me personally, that was kind of the pinnacle moment of the mission for me," he continued. The crew also said they were getting their source of news from planet Earth from their family members. They have been our source of how the mission is going from the public perspective, Wiseman said, before adding, obviously, they're all biased. When asked by the BBC's news science editor Rebecca Morell what the crew will miss most about being space, Christina Koch said she will miss the camaraderie. On what she won't miss, Koch said there wasn't anything. We can't explore deeper unless we've been doing a few things that are inconvenient, unless we're making a few sacrifices, unless we're taking a few risks, and those things are all worth it, she said. The crew now face several quieter days of checks and experiments before a final ordeal. A fiery plunge through the atmosphere at nearly 25,000 miles per hour, and a parachute splashdown into the Pacific that will test the capsule's heat shield and recovery systems. Trapped miner rescued from flooded Mexican tunnel after 14 days. Mexican army divers have rescued a miner from a flooded underground tunnel 2 weeks after he was first trapped. Francisco Zapata Nayeja, 42, was stuck 300 meters below ground after an embankment collapsed at the gold mine in the northern Mexican state of Sinaloa. Video of the rescue shows him standing in waist-deep water, telling his rescuers that he never lost faith during his ordeal. The search continues for another miner who is still missing. 25 workers were inside the gold mine when the tailings dam, a structure which holds mining waste, burst on March 25th. 21 managed to get out, but 4 were trapped. Jose Alejandro Castulo was rescued after 5 days underground, and another miner died, but it took rescuers a full 13 days to locate Francisco Zapata. Following more than 300 hours of searching, divers finally spotted the blinking of the miner's torchlight, which Zapata had turned on and off to alert them to his location. "How are you? How are you?" rescuers asked as they reached him. Once they had identified themselves as specialized military divers, they tell the miner that "your torchlight helped us a lot." "It guided us," one of the divers added. "I didn't lose faith. I didn't lose faith," Zapata told his rescuers. While Zapata appears visibly relieved in the footage, his ordeal was not yet over. Due to the flooding in the tunnel leading to his location, the divers could not immediately extract him. Instead, they left him behind with water, cans of tuna, and energy bars, and a promise to return soon. After 20 more hours in which the rescue teams used pumps to lower the water level in the flooded tunnels, Zapata could finally be taken to the surface. Wrapped in a thermal blanket and sitting on an electric cart, he emerged from the mine on Wednesday and was taken by helicopter to hospital, where he was able to reunite with his family. Doctors said he was frail but stable and would receive the necessary treatment. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum praised the Mexican army and Zapata's faith and resilience, which she said had made the astounding rescue possible. 33 drinks led to the death of a cruise passenger, Miami lawsuit says. The fiancé of a Southern California man is suing Miami-based Royal Caribbean, saying the company is responsible for his death on board after serving him 33 alcoholic drinks in under 12 hours and then using excessive force to subdue him. Michael Virgil, 35, and from Riverside, California, boarded Royal Caribbean's Navigator of the Seas in Los Angeles with fiancée Connie Aguilar and their 7-year-old son. They were starting a 4-day cruise to Ensenada, Mexico. Their room wasn't ready, so they were sent to a bar, according to their lawyers. Later, Aguilar and the boy, who was getting restless, went to check on their cabin. Meanwhile, the cruise staff served Virgil, drink after drink, 33 in total, the complaint alleges. Intoxicated, Virgil tried to find his room, but got lost, the lawsuit said. Then he grew agitated. Crew members who saw him, including security personnel, tackled him to the ground, stood on his body with their full weight, compressed it, and caused him to stop moving, according to the filing. Virgil died shortly later. His body remained on board, stored in refrigeration, until the navigator of the seas returned to Los Angeles on December 16, 2024. His death was classified as a homicide by the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Office, which conducted an autopsy. The use of force by others directly contributed to the physiological conditions leading to death, according to the autopsy report. The FBI launched an investigation, but no charges were filed, an agency spokesman told the Miami Herald. The agency didn't release other information about the case. Aguilar's attorneys told the Herald they're not aware of any criminal charges. On December 5, Aguilar filed the wrongful death civil lawsuit in Miami federal court against Royal Caribbean Cruises Limited, which has an address of Plantation, Florida, but is incorporated in Liberia. Aguilar is represented by Texas firm Kirker Garcia and Boca Raton-based the Russo trial attorneys. While the ship departed from and returned to California, where Aguilar lives, the contract that passengers sign before boarding a Royal Caribbean cruise requires that any litigation must be filed with the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. Royal Caribbean was notified of the lawsuit on December 10 and has 60 days to respond in court. We were saddened by the passing of one of our guests, worked with authorities on their investigation, and will refrain from commenting further on pending litigation, the carrier's chief communications officer, Heather Hurst Rivera, said in an email statement to the Miami Herald on December 11. Aguilar's lawsuit contends Royal Caribbean is liable for Virgil's death. It also accuses the company of negligence, including in hiring, retaining, training, and supervision. This could have been avoided, Anthony Russo, one of the plaintiff's attorneys and founding partner of the Russo trial lawyers, told the Miami Herald. On December 13, 2024, between approximately 10:30 a.m. and 8:30 p.m., the time of death, according to the autopsy report, Royal Caribbean crew members served Virgil at least 33 alcoholic beverages. As a result, Virgil exhibited obvious physical signs of intoxication while in plain view of the crew members serving him these alcoholic beverages, the complaint said. The lawsuit says that the ship had the right to refuse to serve guests who are visibly intoxicated, and said crew members who kept serving him drinks were negligent, causing the passenger to be substantially impaired. The lawsuit also faults the crew line for doing as much as possible to encourage and facilitate alcohol consumption aboard its vessels. It alleges the deluxe beverage package, which Virgil bought, encourages its passengers to overconsume beverages, including alcohol. An intoxicated Virgil started looking for his cabin room and got lost. He then became agitated. The autopsy report states that Virgil was observed engaging in violent and threatening behavior aboard the ship, including shouting profanities in confronting guests and security personnel. Based on a review of ship video by the Los Angeles County Medical Examiner's Office, at 6:07 p.m., Virgil appears to charge at ship security personnel and ends up on the floor of a large stairwell, the lawsuit says. At that time, approximately five ship security guards are on top of him, in a prone position, some standing on him, possibly using their full body weight. After 3 minutes, he stopped moving. He was still breathing and had a pulse, the autopsy report said. The lawsuit says that crew members compressed Virgil's back and torso, and crew members also injected the sedative medication haloperidol and used multiple cans of pepper spray at the request of the staff captain. The compression of Virgil's body by crew members, including security personnel, directly caused significant hypoxia and impaired ventilation, respiratory failure, cardiovascular instability, and ultimately cardiopulmonary arrest, which led to his death, according to the lawsuit. Russo, the lawyer, said from the number of drinks to the way crew members and security handled Virgil after he was intoxicated, this was a perfect storm of negligence. Co-founder of Jalisco New Generation Drug Cartel pleads guilty. The co-founder of the Mexico-based Jalisco New Generation Cartel, or CJNG, Eric Valencia Salazar, has pleaded guilty to drug trafficking charges, the U.S. Department of Justice has announced. Valencia Salazar, known as L85, was captured by the Mexican Army in 2022 in the state of Jalisco, and was among that is a group of 29 alleged drug lords extradited to the United States in February 2025 to end trial. The Drug Enforcement Administration said Valencia Salazar helped build CJNG into a ruthless organization that uses violence as a business model, murdering for control in Mexico while flooding the United States with poison. His sentencing is scheduled on July 31st. In a statement, the DOJ said that Valencia Salazar had changed his earlier not guilty plea to plead guilty to one count of conspiracy to distribute 5 kilograms or more of cocaine to the United States. The mandatory minimum sentence is 10 years in prison. The Jalisco New Generation Cartel is one of the most powerful criminal organizations founded in Mexico. In February, its members unleashed a wave of violence across 20 Mexican states after news spread that its leader, Nemesio Oseguera Cervantes, better known as El Mencho, had died as a result of injuries sustained during his capture by Mexican security forces. Last year, the U.S. President Donald Trump designated the CJNG as a foreign terrorist organization. The Trump administration has stepped up its battle against the cartels, which it says threatens the safety of the American people, the security of the United States, and the stability of the international order in the Western Hemisphere. Trump has also pressured his Mexican counterpart, Claudia Sheinbaum, to do more to combat Mexico-based criminal groups such as the CJNG. The capture and subsequent death of El Mencho was hailed by Sheinbaum as proof of the armed forces' commitment to track down Mexico's most notorious drug lords. Gringos out. Mexicans protest against tourists and gentrification. The timing of the first of several recent anti-gentrification protests in Mexico City was no coincidence. July 4, U.S. Independence Day. Demonstrators gathered in Parque Mexico in Condesa District, the epicenter of gentrification in the Mexican capital, to protest over a range of grievances. Most were angry at exorbitant rent hikes, unregulated holiday lettings, and the endless influx of Americans and Europeans into the city's trendy neighborhoods like Condesa, Roma, and La Juarez, forcing out long-term residents. In Condesa alone, estimates suggest that as many as one in five homes is now a short-term let or a tourist dwelling. Others also cited more prosaic changes, like restaurant menus in English or milder hot sauces at the taco stands, to cater for sensitive foreign palates. But as it moved through the gentrified streets, the initially peaceful protests turned ugly. Radical demonstrators attacked coffee shops and boutique stores aimed at tourists, smashing windows, intimidating customers, spraying graffiti, and chanting Fuera Gringo, meaning gringos out. At her next daily press conference, President Claudia Sheinbaum condemned violence as xenophobic. No matter how legitimate the cause, as is the case with gentrification, the demand cannot be simply to say get out to the people of other nationalities inside our country, she said. Masked radicals and agitators aside, though, the motivation for most people who turned out on July 4 was stories like Erica Aguilar's. After more than 45 years of her family renting the same Mexico City apartment, the beginning of the end came with a knock at the door in 2017. Long-term residents of the Prim Building, a 1920s architectural gem located in La Juarez District, said they were visited by officials clutching eviction papers. Erica, the eldest daughter, recalls the shocking news. They came to every apartment in the building and told us we had until the end of the month to vacate the premises, as they weren't going to renew our rental contracts. You can imagine my mother's face, adds Erica, her voice momentarily wavering. She had lived here since 1977. The owners were selling to a real estate company, but they gave the residents a final, albeit unrealistic, offer. This has been Gene with the BBC World News for Thursday, April 9, 2026.